Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Toby Hagen's with us in the studio this evening. We're talking motor cars under the bonnet. Any question you like, there are lines free. Give him a grab. Grab a hold of him at 1-300-800-222. Toby, good evening. You must be a bit tired. You're fresh off the plane from Geneva.
Fresh off the plane, yeah. Well, I've had a day to half a day to get used to it all. But, first major motor European motor show of the year.
Yep.
And always one of the biggies. So there's a lot of pretty cool stuff that goes on there, and it was no different this year. It's actually, I think, one of the better motor shows I've been to in 4 or 5 years. What we tend to find with a lot of these motor shows recently is everything gets drip fed and told to you before you get to the show, and there was a little bit of that, obviously, but there were also some surprises and a lot of interesting and relevant news about new models coming up.
Yeah, you've seen some beauties. What about this Bentley EXP 12-speed 6E concept. That's the name of the car.
It's one hell of a name, isn't it? Yeah,
but it's an all-electric Bentley.
All-electric Bentley, yeah, which, Rolls-Royce and Bentley, for example, all say that electric in many ways suits their brands because people like the instant torque, the performance you've got from the electric motor, and they also like the refinement and the quietness. So particularly for Rolls-Royce, they're saying it's perfect. But yeah, this Bentley, full electric, they're basically saying that by sort of 2021-ish, they want to have an all-electric car on sale, bring it into the mix of the 8 cylinders and the 12 cylinders that they've already got.
Does that mean everyone will follow, that we'll have an electric roller?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they will, yeah. Rolls-Royce did what they call an experimental car a few years ago now, which was full electric. So, look, I'd be stunned if they didn't. Rolls-Royce is obviously owned these days by BMW. BMW's heavily into that space. So I think we're at a tipping point now, and certainly that was the feeling I got from the motor show, was that there's a lot of car makers there who are starting to at least make sure they're ready to pour the cars into the market, and they admit it comes down to regulators and government incentives and
what's the biggest, because you and I have spoken before about this, there were basically no electric cars sold in Australia last year, one or two.
Yeah, well, the Tesla's the only exception.
But putting aside Tesla, and those things cost $250,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Putting aside those things, there were no electric cars sold in Australia because no one seems to want to buy them. Yeah. Is there, where is the market for these things elsewhere, apart from the super luxury?
Well, okay, so take Norway as a good example. So Norway has very strong government incentives for electric cars. They like to have clean energy and clean motoring and so on. So in some months in Norway, an electric car has been the top-selling car in the country. So you imagine the Toyota Corolla, for example, often the top-selling car here. Imagine if that was an electric car. And that's what you got over there.
Okay, because they've got a lot of charging points, have they?
Yeah, and places like California, where California has incentives again. I think America, it's up to about $7,000 basically off your tax return if you buy one of the cars that matches it. And in California in the past, they've also done things like allowing people to use the carpool lanes, which anyone who's been on the big 405 and the other freeways in LA will realise that is quite an advantage. So when you start to see incentives like that, that's where it takes off. But until we get to that point, and that's where I think a lot of the manufacturers of electric cars are saying to the Australian government, please do something, because at the moment we can bring this technology in and they can sell the cars, but at the moment no one's going to pay the massive premium that's attached to them right now. So, and we've seen that every time. I mean, a lot of people would love to buy an electric car, and certainly if they drove them, they'd be quite impressed. But then they look at the price and say, well, hang on, it's $50,000, and for $30,000 I can get a comparable petrol or diesel car. So they'd rather go and do that and spend a couple of grand a year on fuel.
Why are they more expensive when there's less gear in them? Because they're basically just an electric motor and a battery.
That's right, a lot of batteries.
I mean, there's no more, there's no fuel system, there's no...
No, that's right. That's right, absolutely.
No moving parts in the engine except for the electric motor. Yeah, not many moving parts in that.
Batteries are the big one. So batteries are the thing that everyone is sitting back and saying, we need the batteries to be more affordable. So when you talk about, one of the things that they talk about is energy density. So for example, you get a petrol-powered car, let's say you put roughly 70 or 80 litres of petrol in it, you get about 500 kilometres in your average car. To get 500 kilometres out of a battery system, you need almost double or triple that amount of weight and space in the car taken up. So it's a lot more. And of course, you then got the 6, 8, 10 hour charging time rather than the 5 minute refill. So there's still those compromises there. But look, the main reason is the batteries. The batteries are pretty expensive. They can. I actually went to the General Motors Battery Lab about 6 weeks ago and chatted to the guys doing the testing. The testing facility is incredible in terms of how they test these batteries. And they said, look, when they first started out looking at batteries, they had about 40 or 50 suppliers come to them and say, here are our batteries. They started putting them through all the tests, which obviously include heat, they include humidity, all extreme cold, all that sort of stuff, and a whole bunch of them just failed. They just wouldn't live up to it. And obviously a car needs to go from negative 50 to about 50 degrees Celsius.
Sure.
And it needs to last 6, 8, 10 years. So they found a whole lot of them failed, and they're down to sort of 3 or 4 main suppliers. So you've got your Samsungs and Panasonics and some pretty familiar names that are supplying batteries to various car makers out there.
Okay, all right. You drove the new McLaren 720. Nothing electric in that. V8
it's
engine.
Got headlights.
The Volkswagen Arteon. What's this?
Arteon. So, well, there was there is a car on sale in Australia now called the Passat CC or Coupe. What is it?
Coupe Cabriolet Coupe or something?
No, it was.
CC, look at me.
The Passat CC, which is sort of a sleeker version of the Volkswagen Passat. So it's a replacement for that. But the interesting thing with that one is they're sort of dragging a little bit further up market. So it's probably going to be well into the $60,000. And all of a sudden it bumps up against your entry-level luxury sedan. So BMW 3 Series, Mercedes-Benz C-Class, and the Audi A4. Now, Audi and Volkswagen are the same company. They're both part of the Volkswagen group. So all of a sudden you're going to have a Volkswagen that on the surface looks like it will compete pretty heavily against the car from the same brand.
You also had a chat to the boss of Cadillac in Geneva, and they're planning to come to Australia.
They are, yes. Yeah. So,
really?
What
are they like, caddies? Are they any? Are they? I always think of those big American cars as big boats. I mean, they're tanks. They're mainly to look at me. I mean, their performance is terrible.
Yeah.
Is that still true?
Nothing like that these days. So, look, in the 80s and the 90s, they had the big boats, which were a lot of them were pretty hideous to drive. These days, some really sharp lines on them. The designer, actually, the head designer is an Aussie, so ex-Holden designer. Mm-hmm. He designed Commodores and Utes and all sorts of stuff, and now he's designing Cadillacs. So, but in terms of how they drive, they've done a lot of testing in Europe, for example, the Nürburgring, which is where a lot of the European manufacturers do testing. So they've really brought them up to speed in that regard, and they're trying to take Cadillac global. They had plans to come to Australia. They literally got cancelled at the 11th hour about 2009 or 10 around then, and it was post-GFC. When General Motors went into Chapter 11 bankruptcy over in the States. So they pulled the plug on it. The cars were literally in Australia ready to be sold, and they pulled the plug and ended up sending the cars over to New Zealand. So this is take two of trying to get Cadillac back to Australia, and it's looking like being about 2021. The big issue, as it is with so many American cars, is having the steering wheel on the right-hand side, which we tend to like over here. So they're basically saying, look, in the next generation of cars, which we'll start to see 2019 or 20, they're going to make sure they're right-hand drive, sell them into markets like Europe, so England, where they're also right-hand drive, and that's when they'll bring Australia online. Once they've got, I guess, a war chest of vehicles, 3 or 4 cars at least, they'll bring into the country and off they go. So
you reckon it'll sell here?
Look, the one thing it's got in its favour is that everyone knows Cadillac. It's, you know, pop culture and
that's
movies.
That's true, but if you want to buy an electric car, you usually think European, don't
absolutely,
you?
And that's the thing they're up against, is the strength of the European brands in Australia is just immense. So they're going to have to do, I mean, look, styling will separate them. They do look different to a lot of the European cars. But, you know, they're going to have to come out with something that that really tries to separate them from the rest of the pack, and that's a big challenge.
We're with Toby Hagen. This is Motor Talk. Let's get to some calls. Mark, hello.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, Toby, my daughter's looking at buying the Audi A2. She wants the 2-litre petrol engine when it comes out in, I think it's August.
Yep.
What can you tell me about it, and if you know what sort of price we're looking at?
So you mean Q2?
Q2, sorry.
Q2, look, in terms of pricing, the base price...
That's a little SUV.
Yeah, the smallest SUV. Yeah. So it just went on sale about 2 weeks ago, something like that. And look, base price, it's 41 grand plus on road, so sort of 43-44 as a starting price. And then you can get the all-wheel drive model, diesel. So look, I would think the 2-litre petrol will be closer to 50, somewhere around there.
Yep.
So it's not going to be super cheap. And one of the things is you look at the Q3, which is Underneath, it's actually similar size, but the body is slightly bigger, and the Q3 brings more space. But look, a great-looking SUV. They've put a lot of gear in it, so things like your active safety systems, your autonomous emergency braking and so on is all packed into it. So a good little car from that perspective. Keep in mind, obviously, Mercedes-Benz with GLA. The GLA is a smaller car, a much smaller car, but there's an update to that coming in a few months. And, of course, BMW X1, which is probably a little bit bigger as well. But no, look, Q2... I've only driven it very briefly, and it's it all seemed to be a very good car for what it was.
Yeah, see, you went and had a look at the one they had in Australia the other day, bit of diesel.
Yep.
But they're very quiet on about the petrol engine one. They're not talking too much about it. So
yeah, right.
Sort of,
well, they've got the 1.4 petrol now, but yeah, you want the 2-litre one, so...
Yeah.
So, yeah, look, as I said, all I know is that I believe the intention is to sell it here. And pricing, as I said, best guess, I think it'll be around that 50 grand drive away, something like that. Plus your options, you can throw a lot of options on that. Things like a thing they call virtual cockpit, which is a really funky, instead of your traditional instrument cluster, you've got to, instead of fixed gauges, you've got a customizable screen. So that's pretty cool. And things like smart key entry, where you just go and grab the door handle or open it, that costs extra as well. So there's extras on there that can quickly jump that price up a bit, but otherwise, yeah, it should be fairly sharp.
Okay.
Good on you, Mark. Thank you.
Yep, thanks for that.
Bye-bye. Judith. Judith from Halliday's Point. Hello, Judith.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Toby.
Hi.
Hello. Yes,
Judith, you're coming through loud and clear. What's your question?
Okay. Look, I'm looking at getting a new car.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for a small car, a sedan. And I've been looking at the Subaru Impreza and Toyota Corolla.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah.
Okay, so Impreza, you've looked at the new Impreza, the new sedan?
Yes.
Because that would only just be into the market, I think. They got the hatch late last year.
Actually, it was the hatch that I looked at had a test drive. They didn't have the sedan.
That's what I was thinking. So I was thinking if the sedan's here, it's only just lobbed, because I haven't driven the sedan yet. I've driven the hatch.
Yeah.
Look, out of those two cars, I would certainly put the Impreza ahead. It's come from being a very mediocre little small car to being quite a good one. So they've done some great stuff with rear legroom, for example, refinement. I think they've done a terrific job in terms of bringing that car up to speed. And it's a really nice package for what it is. If you can go for the, I think it's the 2.0 IS or the IL.
I was looking at.
So the one with the autonomous braking and so on in there, it's just that extra step of safety.
Yeah.
So yeah, but as I said, out of those two, I'd go that. Look, worth having a look at the Mazda 3. The Mazda 3 is not going to be as refined, particularly road noise. So in terms of, you know, sitting on a freeway or something, you'll get more tyre noise coming through the cabin. But the Mazda 3 is also pretty good buying as well. But yeah, look, Corolla's all right. And look, space is the big thing with that Corolla. It's got a lot of space, particularly in the back seats, and it's... they've done a decent job with that. But it's starting to, as I said, just feel a little bit tired compared with the Subaru, which is a good, fresh, small car.
Right. Okay. Yes, I'm up on the mid-north coast, so I do a lot on the highway.
Yeah.
And I was looking for something that has that little bit of power to get up and around, you know, an old car.
Yep.
And also for longevity. I wanted to just go for a long time.
Either of those two you're looking at, the Corolla and the Impreza, they are both gold in terms of longevity. So you should comfortably get 200,000 Ks plus, you know, probably 300,000 if you look after it. So, and 10 years plus pretty easily if you look after it. So it's, so look, they're both fantastic for that. But as I said, I'd take the Impreza over the Corolla in that market.
Okay.
All right. Great.
Thanks,
okay.
Judith.
Thank you.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Good on you. Andy from Melbourne. Hello, Andy.
Oh, good evening. Thank you very much for taking my call tonight.
You're very welcome.
I have a Mazda 2 2008 at the moment, looking at trading that in for something a little bigger, possibly a later model used car. I've been looking at the Corolla, but I'm wondering what else you would suggest, keeping in mind that I'm looking for something that's good with fuel, and I do intend to start driving for Uber at some point. So what would you suggest apart from the Corolla?
Well, look, Corolla would be high on the list, I guess, partly because there'll be a heap of them on the market. A lot of those small cars are all, well, they're all pretty good on fuel. You could look at a diesel-powered one. There aren't many, there wouldn't be many on the used car market. For doing something like Uber, diesel could potentially be worth it, but you bring in some other negatives for short distance touring and so on. So be aware of that. Look, a couple of others to stick on the list. Ford Focus is would actually be in that second-hand market a reasonable buy for what it is. The only caveat I'd put on that is they've had a lot of issues with the automatic transmission, so the twin clutch transmission on the petrol ones, not on the diesel. So only the petrol ones had those issues. So I'd be very cautious of that. But the later ones, the 1.5 litre engine, a 1.5 litre turbo, that got a different transmission which doesn't have those issues. So if you can snap into one of them, it wouldn't be too bad. Another one to look at would either be Hyundai i30 or Hyundai Elantra. So both, same basic car, one's a hatch, one's a sedan. For that sort of thing, again, a lot of them on that used car market, you'll probably get into one cheaper than you will a Corolla because they don't hold their value quite as well as a Corolla. And you've got the 5-year warranty to go with it. So, something like that could work as well.
Okay, and what sort of pricing roughly for the i30 or Elantra?
Well, look, the i30s last year, they were doing them 20 grand drive away for an automatic. So that's brand new. So on the used market, I would expect a top-notch one would probably be something like 17. For a base model, keep in mind, obviously, once you start adding the leather and all that stuff, it's gonna be a higher price. But I would have thought you could get into one 2 or 3 years old for somewhere around 13, 14 grand for a good example. And it will still have, as I said, the 5-year warranty, so you'll have a couple of years of warranty easy on it.
Okay.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Andy. Good on you. Bye-bye. We're with Toby Hagen. This is Motor Talk, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222, if you'd like to ask Toby a question.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Philip Clark.
Okay, and our text line on 0467 922 702, 1300 800 222, if you'd like to ask a question. There are some lines free if you want to grab one. Let's get to some text here, Toby. When you ask Toby, when listeners want his opinion on the best small cars, says Ken from Hobart, he always lists Mazda 2 and Honda Jazz, but seems to ignore Australia's most popular small car, the Yaris. I think you said last time we spoke, actually, you don't think much of the Yaris, do you?
The Yaris is just feeling a bit tired in that market. So one of the biggest issues it's got, the automatic version, only gets a 4-speed automatic. So it's and most of the cars in that market now get at least a 6-speed.
Yep.
So that makes a big difference, particularly for around town. If you get on a freeway in particular, or even an 80k an hour zone, you're going to notice that the engine just tends to start making a bit of noise and it feels a bit underpowered. So none of those things are rocket ships. But as I said, that's one of the main reasons. They just haven't done a whole lot with it. And look, keep in mind, I guess if we went purely on sales, then restaurant of the year would be McDonald's.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily, that's why we're here, Ken, trying
to give you a bit more spirited advice than other than what's right. The most popular seller.
Yeah. Now look, it's a little bit different in the car market, but there's a Yaris will go on and on and on. There's a lot of good points to it. But I just think in that market, there's some better cars out there. Mm. Look, these days they're doing some pretty sharp deals on them, and that makes them a bit more attractive. But as I said, the 4-speed auto, the interior that's starting to date a bit, those sorts of things are probably the main reason I rank it down a fraction.
Okay. Evening, Philip and Toby. Thanks for the program. Thank you. Your thoughts, please, on a two-year-old VW Touareg V6 diesel auto, 150 TDI, as a tow vehicle for a 2.5 to 2.8 ton caravan.
Yeah, look, off the
top, they don't have low range.
Yeah, I wouldn't be concerned about the low range. The only time that would really come in is if you're on a very steep boat ramp or something like that, and you might want to chuck it down in a low range. But look, a heap of torque from that thing, so shifting a heavy boat shouldn't be an issue. I don't know off the top of my head what the tow capacity of that car is. That would certainly be getting up to it. It wouldn't be over 3 tons, so you'd be knocking on the door of the tow capacity for it. Engine was a great engine. That V6 diesel is a really nice engine, and the car generally is pretty sharp. So they've, Touareg's been around a while now, and there is a new one due soon-ish. But as a decent sort of tow vehicle, certainly be comfortable in everything. It would do a good job from that perspective.
Okay, Toby, any problems with carbon build-up with direct injection engines, and also doing mainly short trip driving? We have an IZ Focus.
Oh, yeah.
With a 1.5-litre turbo engine, Rob from Geelong. Evening, Rob.
Yeah, look, I'm not... Not that I'm aware of in the petrol engine, so that one's the petrol one. The diesels have the issue with the particulate filters, which can clog up on those short distances. Yep. I haven't heard of any issues with... with the injectors and so on short distances. So okay. I wouldn't be as concerned about that. I mean, look, a lot of those cars, particularly the small cars, are designed primarily for that, short trips around town. And yeah, I wouldn't be overly concerned.
Okay. Andrew says, Toby, your views on the Range Rover Sport as an SUV?
Rangy,
or any other alternatives?
Yeah, look, Rangy Sport's a great car for people who want to go to the snow, those sorts of things. It is extremely capable off-road. One of the issues it's got off-road is the tyres. They put enormous tyres on them with quite low profile. So I think the smallest tyres you can get on them are 19-inch with quite a low profile on them. So if you're planning on doing some outback travelling or a lot of dirt road stuff, I'd be cautious. If you just want to zap around town and maybe go down the occasional gravel road, and go to the snow, as I said, that sort of thing. Fantastic car. And look, few people do it as well as Range Rover in terms of getting the balance between a really nice driving on-road car and a car that can do some decent off-roading, and they've done a great job with that Sport. Mm. Expensive, though, and that's one thing by the time you start ticking option boxes, a lot of Land Rovers and Jaguars, which is the sister brand, in Australia at the moment, what you found is the German manufacturers are putting a heap of gear in their cars, and Land Rover and Jag have been a little slow off the mark. So to meet that similar level of specification, you've sometimes got to tick a lot of option boxes, and they can get hideously expensive once you start doing that.
All right, we're up. RVW updating the Touareg anytime soon. We just answered that question. Your thoughts on the new Tiguan? This is Mark in Brisbane. We've talked about this, haven't we?
Yeah. The new Tiguan is a huge step up on the previous one. So they've addressed one of the issues with the last one, boot space. So particularly for families wanting to stick prams and so on in them, it had some issues there. So it is by far the best driving of those mid-sized SUVs.
Okay.
And it's got plenty of space these days. Still got a premium over the key contenders, your RAV4s and Mazda CX-5s and so on. And it needs premium unleaded if you're buying the petrol ones, so keep that in mind. But it doesn't use much fuel. It's a pretty efficient thing.
Here's a Holden or Ford question. It is a Holden or Ford, sort of. Tradie, a farmer from Western New South Wales, says, evening, gents, 4x4 ute, Hilux or Ranger?
Well, Toyota or Ford.
Yeah.
Look, I would, if you're going to be doing a lot of serious off-roading and you want to put a heap of weight in it, I'd probably put the Toyota fractionally ahead.
Yep.
For almost everything else, I'd put the Ford ahead. So the Ford is, they've done a nicer job with it driving on-road. It's got a better drivetrain, so the engine and so on is a little bit better. It's got a bit more power, and they've done a great job. Where Toyota excels is the really rough road stuff, the driving it with half a ton in the back over pretty poor roads, and the things like the traction control system in that Hilux is sensational. So for off-roading stuff, it's a step above pretty much everything in that ute market. But as I said, it's a little bit compromised in other ways. So you're not looking at, in terms of both of those, they're both great utes. They're both towards the top of the segment. So
you can't really miss with either of them, can you, in a way? Hello, Sally. Hi, Toby. What do you think of the 2017 Kia Sportage SI Premium?
I think the Sportage is good. I think the Hyundai Tucson, which shares a lot of components with it, I think the Tucson is probably a fraction better. The advantage with the Sportage, it gets the longest warranty in that market, so you get a 7-year warranty. It's still a very good car for what it is in terms of those mid-sized SUVs. I would say absolutely. Just all I'd say is go and have a look at the Hyundai Tucson as well, because that's also pretty good buying in that market.
Okay. Peter says, what sort of car comes with an individual aircon and a speed radar detector?
I don't think anything comes with a speed radar
detector.
Nothing
comes with it. They're illegal. They're illegal.
Unless he's talking radar cruise control. Possibly.
Oh, yeah. Maybe, yeah.
In which case, there's heaps. These days, there's a heap of cars that'll do that. So if it's radar cruise control you're after, as in the thing that maintains a set distance or a set time to the car in front, there's plenty of those. The vast majority of the luxury cars these days have got it, even things down to, you know, Subaru Outbacks and that sort of stuff. So a Subaru Outback, for example, you'd be able to get those sorts of features on that.
Sure. Okay. All right. I want to talk about SUVs in a minute. We'll just grab a couple of these calls. People have been waiting on. Greg from the Central Coast.
Hey, guys. How are you going?
Well, thank you.
All right. Quickly, I have a 2009 Tiguan, 2-litre TSI, 200,000 Ks-ish. I have been through all the common issues with the TSI motors, 2 litres, well known. They're expensive. I want to get rid of it before the turbo blows. That's the short of it.
Uh-huh.
I've been considering Subaru, the Forester, Outback, the Sportage, the Tucson and the CX-5. The Kia and the Hyundai are the only two cars that I cannot find common issues with.
You cannot find what?
Common issues.
Common problems.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, hence I'm staying away from all the others. The Subaru is serviced every 6 months.
Yeah.
Versus everything else, 12 months. 15,000.
Yeah, well, Mazda's only just gone to that 12-month, and the negative with the Mazda is you've got to do it every 10,000 Ks. So so if you're doing 20,000 Ks a year, you're getting it serviced every 6 months anyway. Whereas a lot of people, particularly Europeans, have stretched out their service intervals over the last sort of 5 or 10 years, and I think it's the little Range Rover Evoque or some of those new Range Rovers, I think you get 2 years and 34,000 Ks between services. So not even changing your oil in 2 years is for a lot of, I know there'll be a lot of mechanics shaking their head at that. But look, in terms of issues and so on, let's start with the Subarus. If your budget stretches, I'd definitely go the Outback over the Forester. I'm just a bigger fan of that Outback, as well as the space. You get more features in it, you get more refinement. So for me, it's the better bet out of those two. CX-5, keep in mind there's a new CX-5 coming in about, what are we, March? In about 3 weeks, something like that. 3 or 4 weeks, there's an all-new CX-5 coming. So it will have the same basic engines as the current car, but it gets an all-new body with some significant updates, things like air vents in the rear, which is important for people who've got kids and live in hot parts of Australia, and things like that. So it's a big step up. What else? Between the Tucson and the Sportage, same as the previous buyer. So I think probably the Tucson buyer knows, but both of them are good cars. And as I said, you get that extra 2 years of warranty in the Kia. So look, in terms of longevity and lack of issues, you're definitely looking in the right end of the market. And I think all those cars you mentioned will provide fewer issues than what you experienced with your Tiguan. Volkswagen has lifted its game, but some people obviously have been a bit burnt by some of the issues they had 5 odd years ago.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will be getting a diesel, and the Mazda and Subaru do have DPF issues.
Yeah, well, the Mazda, very early on in that car's life, they had some issues with overfilling of oil and so on. And anything with a diesel particulate filter is potentially going to have those issues, where if you're doing short trips, they'll clog up. And look, we're sort of in the early life of some of the diesel particulate filters, and I've certainly heard of some brands. I know Nissan Navaras were having issues at one stage at 60,000 odd kilometres with diesel particulate filters giving up, and they can be pretty expensive to replace. So, it's definitely a little bit of a watch and learn on that one.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks, mate. Good on you. Bye-bye. Milan from Singleton's been hanging on to. Hi, Milan.
How are you, lads?
Yeah, where you go, Milan?
Yeah, mate. We're looking at going back to a dual cab ute, and I see they're releasing the Mercedes-Benz ute next year. I was just wondering, what do you know about it? What are your thoughts? And yeah.
I actually, at Geneva Motor Show 2 days ago, was chatting to the head of Mercedes-Benz vans about this exact car. So we know a fair bit about it. It's going to, underneath, you may not know, it's based on the Nissan Navara. So it actually uses the chassis and basic components of a Nissan Navara. It will come out of a Nissan factory. So it'll be a Mercedes-Benz out of a Nissan factory.
Is that right?
Yeah, so it's a little...
Yeah, I have heard something along those lines,
So it's really a Nissan Navara, is it?
Well, yes and no. So, yeah, a lot of those key parts are, but Mercedes is actually doing a lot of work. That Navara's had some... has been relatively lukewarmly received. So they're doing a lot of work to try and address that. So they're going to change a lot of the stuff on there. So, for example, it gets the base ones, the four cylinders, get the same engine as the Navara, which is the more powerful engine, the twin turbo version of the four cylinder, or you can get a Mercedes V6 diesel. So that one's obviously going to be the pick of the engines. It's going to be the most powerful ute when it arrives in Australia, most powerful dual cab ute. I've seen the concepts, the two concepts that they've got running around the world. I've sat in them. I've looked at them. I think they look fantastic. everything we've seen, Mercedes is doing a lot of work on addressing those, or making it, I guess, what they call a proper Merc. They're going to do quite a bit of testing in Australia. So this year, they're going to start running around in some prototype cars in Australia. So they're going to do some off-roading, some high-speed corrugations, all those sorts of things that I guess make a Ute a tougher thing. So look, all indications are it's going to be a reasonable car. Obviously, we haven't driven it yet, so we're not sure, but it will come with a price premium. So don't expect it to be your $50,000 Ute. It's just not going to come in at that sort of end of the market. It's going to be, I think, best guesses, probably starting at the mid 60 mark and heading north of that.
A lot of dough for a Ute.
Well into the 80 grand. So it's you're going to be paying a bit for it, but look, terrific looking car. And as I said, they're doing a lot of engineering work to make sure it lives up to the brand.
Hmm.
No worries.
All right, Milan.
Okay, thank you.
Good on you. Bye-bye. Look out for it. You need a fair bit of, you need a Ute load of cash to buy it.
You do, but that end of the Ute market is booming at the moment. So
this is premium Utes.
Yeah, premium Utes. So Toyota Hilux, for example, the SR5, the $60,000 plus one, that's the top seller in the Hilux
range.
Who's buying it? It's a mix. There's
not tradies.
No, the tradies tend to go for the cheaper ones, obviously, the stripped out ones. You get some tradies who say, "Yeah, I want a decent car like that."
But I want to put on the dog a bit.
Yeah, that's right. But it's people stepping out of SUVs who are saying, okay, I can get that. I can get the towing ability. I can get the off road. I can get all those sorts of things. There's people stepping out of, I had a mate who bought one. He was in a BMW hatchback previously, and he went and bought a dual cab Ute. So it's such a broad range of people. So Utes are now appealing to people who 5-10 years ago would not have even had them on their radar. But now that they can get the safety features, the luxury, the performance, they're saying, let's go and at least have a look.
Is it all about the, about the size of them? You're sitting up a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So design and look and seating position and so on, 100%. So design's still the number one thing with the vast majority of car purchases. So that comes into it. Look, all those Utes, every single one of those Utes, you make enormous compromises in terms of their on-road driving. So they're nowhere near as good as your average passenger car. They bounce around. They're pretty comparatively unwieldy around corners. So they're not up there, but they've got other advantages.
Well, if you're driving around metropolitan Australia, you can't get fast anyway.
No, that's right.
SUVs are now more popular than traditional passenger cars, according to the latest sales figures.
They are indeed, yeah. So
39.9% of sales were SUVs compared to 39% of passenger cars. So they've done it.
That's right. So I was writing stories only a couple of months ago saying in the next 18 months we're expecting this to happen, and it's happened in February 2017. Now, a bit of an unusual market. The market was down about 8%. So the entire market dropped off a fair bit from where it was in February last year.
Mm-hmm.
Look, SUVs, just that onslaught of small SUVs in particular, but the mid-size ones have also seen enormous growth. So things like Hyundai Tucson, very strong. Kia Sportage is selling double what it was 12 months ago. So that one we've been chatting about. Mitsubishi is very strong in SUVs, very weak in passenger cars. And Nissan's another one. Again, weak in passenger cars, strong in SUVs. So you start adding all that up and just the critical mass that SUVs have got. And all of a sudden, next month it might go back the other way. But I think in the next year or two, it will pretty much stick as SUVs the most popular. In America, for example, I was chatting to someone at Geneva Show, and they said if you look at about 5 or 10 years ago, and the market was roughly 58%, I think it was, passenger cars, and 30-something percent SUVs with trucks and so on the rest.
Mm.
They say now that's spun around exactly the opposite. So SUVs are almost 60% of the US market. So and that's pretty much where our market is pointing to, is certainly getting over the 50% SUVs eventually.
Mm. Wow. Okay. And Holden's down the toilet, according to the sales figures. And they've got other problems.
That's a nice way to put it.
You were talking to the general manager of the GM president.
The president of General Motors,
And at the Geneva Motor Show. That's talking to the absolute monkey and not the...
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And they've sold their European division, so Holden's going to be in all sorts of bother looking to source some key models to flesh out their range.
Well, that's it. So the key message Holden's been giving us and the public for the last couple of years is, A, we're here to stay, because obviously they shut manufacturing October 20 this year. And beyond that, they're going to continue as an import-only brand. So the brand itself will hang around.
Mm.
So the message they've been telling is that, and they've also been saying we've got 24 new models coming by 2020. Now, of those 24 models, 1/3 of them are planned to come out of Opel, which is the European division, big manufacturing facility in Europe.
Yeah.
So one of them is on sale now, which is the Holden Astra. So that one's already selling straight out of the Opel factories. Another one is the Commodore. So in February next year, a year from now, we'll be getting an all-new Commodore. It'll be the first ever imported Commodore. That will come from Opel. So suddenly, when these cars start to reach the end of their model cycle, Holden has to work out somewhere to buy them from. So they can continue buying them from PSA, which is the parent company to Peugeot and Citroën, which is the company that's bought Opel. But I dare say General Motors and Holden aren't going to be too keen on buying a car from a competitor.
From basically a competitor.
That's right. So they will have to start looking around at other parts of the General Motors world and say, where can we get these cars? Well, obviously, America's a strong contender.
Yeah, but it won't be the same car. It'll be a completely different car.
Yeah, that's right. So look, they've got massive challenges ahead in terms of, you know, they've got enough challenges. This is arguably the most challenging year in Holden's 69-year history as a manufacturer in Australia. And all of a sudden, they've now got to deal with, well, hey, where do we get a third of our range from? Now, to be fair, they have quite a bit of time up their sleeve. So those cars that I've talked about, they've got sort of a 5-6 year model life, possibly longer. So, you know, they've got a number of years to work it out, but it's not exactly the news they were hoping to hear.
It's going to be like the parrot sketch, isn't it? That's a Commodore. No, it's not.
Well, look, that's another can of worms altogether. There's a lot of people who think it just won't be Holden without locally made cars, particularly a Commodore. So, Holden's had the luxury of producing exactly the car that it's decided that Australians liked, and they've done that since 1948. All of a sudden, they've got to just pluck off the shelf
some car from some other part of the world.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, very different proposition to where they've been.
It sure is. It sure is. Let's get back to some calls. Sorry, Tony, you've been waiting on there. Hello.
G'day, Toby. Thanks very much for taking the call. I've got an SV6 Holden 3.6 litre, 6-speed auto. I love it. I love the handling. I love that you put your boot down and it responds unbelievably. Nearly the same fuel economy as my daughter in her Astra.
Mm-hmm.
She's a bit of a lead foot. So do I buy it?
She might get apple never falls far from the tree, Tony.
Yeah. Do I get one in October, another one, or do I go to something else? That's the big question that I have. What do I do in October?
Look, I wouldn't have any issue whatsoever suggesting to someone to go and buy one of the Commodores this year. Because I think for exactly what you've mentioned, in terms of particularly long-distance comfort, there's almost nothing on the market at the affordable end of the market that gets close to those cars. They are just sensational in terms of their overall comfort. And as you say, effortless performance can be relatively efficient if you don't go booting them around too much. You can certainly use a lot of fuel in a Commodore, particularly the V8 ones, if you get pretty enthusiastic with them. But drive them gently, and people are often surprised at how economical they can be. Now, you can certainly get more economical cars. You can get diesels these days, which will use 30-40% less than that pretty comfortably. But as I said, in terms of an overall car that does it just so nicely, I would say if you're happy with the current Commodore, 100% go and buy another one. And if you can, stretch to the V8 because that thing's awesome. You'll use a bit more fuel. Look, V8 Commodores...
You'll beat your daughter off from the lights maybe, Tony.
That's okay, but what if I can't buy it? What do I transfer to if I can't get it?
So what? You can't because why?
Well, it's the government's car. I get private use.
Oh, right,
and they may say to me,
okay,
sorry, you're not allowed to buy another one.
Yeah,
you have to buy an equivalent in another brand.
Got it.
Yeah, right. Okay, there's that's a much trickier one. So you can go to something like a Mazda 6, but it's not going to have the performance that you've got now. It's not going to have... it's going to have the handling. It's a very good car through the corners, but it's not going to have the quietness, so the refinement and so on. It's still got a little bit of road noise issue. Look, something like a Subaru Outback that I touched on earlier, that's a very good sort of compromise car, but again, it's not. I don't think it's going to match the Commodore on overall dynamics and so on. So then you're stepping up into, you can get into some low-end luxury cars, but I'm not sure the government's going to want to go buying you a Mercedes C-Class or an Audi A4. Audi A4 is a great car, but again, you're up over 60 grand there. So yeah, it's a tricky one. And look, SUVs that we've been talking about are where you go next. But the problem with an SUV compared with a Commodore, you've got a higher center of gravity. So you're all sitting up high, which gives you a great view and everything. but it compromises you through the corners. So the car has a, it wants to lean more. It's got a tendency to lean, and they counter that by stiffening the suspension. So they firm up the suspension a tiny bit. Now, some SUVs, you notice it more than others, particularly the sporty ones. You get into a Porsche Cayenne or a BMW X5 or something, they're pretty stiffly sprung. So they're, you know, around the corners, you certainly know, or over the bumps, sorry, you certainly notice them. And through the corners, they're fantastic. So it's all a compromise.
All right, mate. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good on you. Bye-bye. John from Sydney. Hello, John.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Quick question if I might, and thank you for taking the call. Bought last August, September, new GTS. Done a couple of thousand kilometres on it. Wondering whether it's worthwhile picking up a new GTR from HSV now.
Yeah, so GTSR is the GTSR. One you're talking about.
Yeah,
so,
is it worth the difference? Is it worth the bother?
So you almost certainly won't notice the performance. It's gone up from 430 kilowatts. We're talking about HSV GTS for the people who didn't get that.
Yep.
So 430 kilowatts to 435 kilowatts. And anyone who can pick 5 kilowatts when you're talking 430, you're doing pretty well. Yep. I mean, you'll notice it on a racetrack. You know, you might be doing a K an hour quicker down the straight, but that'd be about it. It's going to be pretty minor.
I don't go to too many racetracks.
Yeah. So, but look, where you absolutely will notice it, so that GTSR, the one that they're doing as a send-off special, is they've widened the front track. So the distance between the left and right front wheels is slightly wider, and they've put a stickier set of tyres on it and a much better set of brakes. So braking is better and cornering. So you'll notice it a little bit sharper through the corners, but you're going to pay more for it. So that's the challenge as to whether you step up. Look, I wouldn't be in a major rush. I think the car you've got is a great car.
Yeah.
You're going to dump money, obviously, switching from that one to one of the new ones. You're going to dump probably quite a bit. So with all that in mind, I would say probably not, but you'll get a better car, but it's not massively better. The one that is the big step up is the W1, the $180,000 one.
didn't want manual, wouldn't know what the price was. I just didn't want manual.
Yeah, right.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, but look, as I said, GTSR is a great car. It's a fantastic send off for that the Commodore based HSV. But it's, you know, as I said, you're going to dump a fair bit of money getting out of your one into that one, and that'd be my concern.
And Toby, is it worth dumping it? That's the question.
You mean getting rid of your one?
Yeah, is it worth the bother? Is there enough in it to make it worth the bother?
Look, if it was my money, I don't think I'd do it. The temptation obviously is to sit there and say, well, hang on, the GTSR is slightly better. And certainly, as I said, dynamically you'll notice it. Performance, you're not really going to notice it. But, and look, the other thing that they have done a good job on, the sound, they've made it so the bimodal exhaust that you've got that kicks in, I think it's above about 4,000 revs and it makes that awesome noise. They've now made it so that kicks in at lower revs. So sound-wise, it's going to sound like you're going faster. It'll be great.
Well, that's not better than going faster anyway.
Good on you, John.
Thanks for your help.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. That's funny. Andrew from... Andrew, they'll have virtual reality windscreen soon to make you seem like you're going fast when you're going down, you know, when you're going down the CBD in Sydney or Melbourne. Andrew from Maroubra says, can you recommend between a Golf GTI and a Mercedes A250 or wagon?
Look, Golf GTI used to own that market.
That's a hot hatch, isn't it?
Yeah, the $50,000 hot hatch market. The GTI was so far ahead of everything else, and it was the one to get. But that A250 Merc it's surprised me. Every time I jump into one, you think, wow, they've done a fantastic job with this. And look, the A3 as well. S3, I think it would be that the competitor for that. So that's a good thing. But you're paying more because it's the Audi rather than the Volkswagen. Look, keep in mind there's a new GTI coming, a facelifted GTI coming late this year. So Golf. So that is going to step up a bit there when they do that. Of the current two cars, I wouldn't say no to either one of those. If it was me, I'd probably go the Volksy. I think particularly with things like rear seat space, you're getting more space in there. Mm-hmm. So there's a few little reasons like that I'd jump into the Golf. And I think that latest Golf GTI is just such a nice little car, such a great all-rounder. You can potter around town doing nothing, or you can find a great piece of road and have some fun. So it's a good little car.
Okay. All right, this is Nightlife. You're with Philip Clark and our guest tonight, Toby Hagen. This is Motor Talk. If you've got a question, 1-300-800-222.
You're with Philip Clark on ABC Radio. It's Nightlife.
I love this. Ferrari's in trouble. because they're winding back the speedos.
Well, we should say alleged. We should say reports.
No, we'll get letters now.
So look, there's a lawsuit in the US where a dealer, sounds like a disgruntled dealer, has claimed that the software that they use to tune the cars, so all the car makers create their own software for the dealers and so on, and they're claiming that the Ferrari software actually allows them to wind back the autos. And this dealer claims that one particular owner wound back the auto on a LaFerrari. So this is the Ferrari LaFerrari, the fastest car they've ever produced, the most expensive Ferrari they've ever sold. Wasn't sold in Australia, but it's a multi-million dollar price tag. And he claims that by winding it back, it increased the value by $1 million. So there was a fair incentive for the dealer to do it, if what he says is true. But look, obviously, interestingly, Ferrari's refusing to comment, which sort of suggests that it might be there, because you would have thought if they don't have that software there, they would have just come straight out and said, no, we haven't got this.
I was fascinated. I was interested when you mentioned this, because it made me wonder about, you know, because all odometers these days are electronic.
Yeah.
You know, there's not the little wheels anymore.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So, how, I mean, if it's just electronic, can they be wound back easily?
Not easily. So, there's some fairly solid measures in there to make sure that they can't.
Right.
I know in the past, there's some that have allowed you to do it if the car's got less than 1,000 Ks on it. I know in some situations.
Which is fair enough. I think that's fair enough. Yeah.
But no, very, very difficult. So the easiest way, and this is what some people have done in the past, is to replace the entire instrument cluster. So to change that altogether. But an instrument cluster, obviously, it's got to be a pretty big crash when you're damaging the instrument cluster. You've got a lot of damage.
Can you do that? But
on.
Hang on, if you change the instrument cluster, so it carries the odometer reading with it, does it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's part of that, I believe.
So if you go to a wrecker.
Yeah, you could potentially get that, but... See, if you go into a wrecker, the car's old enough, and the car in the wrecker is probably going to have a high gas on it anyway. So, but if you go and order a new one off the manufacturer, I believe they get a bit sus and say, well, hang on, why do you need an instrument cluster? And they'll then try, and I think they can potentially match it to the one that you're switching over.
Okay.
So look, they're very strict on that sort of stuff, and they try and make sure that, obviously, you know, the integrity of the car is maintained. People don't want to have a car and see that it's all looking pretty ordinary. It's saying 30,000 on the auto, and it looks like it's got wear of 300,000.
Sarah is in northern New South Wales. Hi, Sarah. What is your recommendation, Toby, for the best small SUV?
I'm actually going to be doing tests on exactly this shortly, so I'll have the answer in about 2 weeks. Look, of the current crop, there's a whole bunch. The Mazda CX-3 is a reasonable car. It's got a few tiny suspension issues, and it's very small inside, particularly backseat. Honda HR-V has been probably one of the standouts, so that's a really nice car, a good all-round sort of package. But I'm actually driving at the moment the new Toyota CHR, and that is... I would certainly say it's very close to the top of that class, if not top. So it's a big step up. It makes some good gains on that end of the market. So look, I would say Toyota CHR, Honda HR-V towards the top. Have a look at the CX-3 if you can live with that rear seat space. Also have a look at a Suzuki Vitara, real left fielder, and you make some trade-offs in terms of overall comfort. It's a bit more basic, but it drives quite nicely. The turbocharged version, which they all are now, has got decent performance and decent space and a heap of gear in it for the money.
Okay. All right. We've got time, yes we have, for a couple more questions. Michael's on the line from Perth. Hello, Michael.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah. Hey, Toby, I'm curious, and I've been researching fuel chips, so performance chips for diesel engines.
Yep.
And there's lots of wild claims out there about what they can deliver and what they can't. So I'm just interested in your views, right?
Yeah, I'd be very cautious. So as you pointed out, there are lots of wild claims. And the claims that come out and say you can use X amount less fuel and we'll give you all this extra power and all this other stuff, I'm always very sus on that, because without changing a whole lot of other stuff in the engine, often, you know, if you're going to get more power out of that same engine, often you've got to put more fuel in. So they can quite easily get more power by changing computer chips and so on these days, but there will be compromises somewhere else. Now, whether that's long-term reliability, whether it's fuel economy, all those sorts of things, you know, it might be refinement. It might be, you know, one of the things with turbos, for example, if you wick the turbo boost up, so you make the turbo so it's thrusting more, you'll often impact drivability. So things like, you know, when you get back on the power, it takes longer to wind the turbo back up. So all those sorts of factors are things to keep in mind. So I'd be very cautious. I would also, I'm not sure I'd do it on a car that's still under the factory warranty, because they will figure that out if the engine goes bang. And it'll also be, I'd try and find an example of a car that they have done in the past. So I'd do a lot of research online, maybe speak to some owners that have had them, and just try and get a feel for, as I said, actually physically go and drive one, do what you need to do in it in terms of towing and so on, and check all that stuff like drivability and fuel economy to make sure that it's even vaguely living up to the claims. But yeah, be cautious. Yeah, you're absolutely right to be cautious, yeah.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, thanks, guys.
Good on you, mate. Bye-bye. A couple of things before we go, too. The new BMW 5 Series, you say, can be parked by remote control.
Remote control. So this is...
How does that work?
Well, it's... it does pretty much everything. You've got a pretty fancy little remote. It's almost like a mini smartphone.
What, so you can stop the car in the middle of the street outside your house.
Jump out. Off you go.
With your shopping, and then just press a button and it'll park itself.
Now, most people are going to...
That's illegal, isn't it?
Right. No, it's not. They've got it past the authorities.
Really?
So, yeah, early on they had to not have it in one of their other cars, but now they've got it past them. So, look, there are lots of safeguards. So, for example, you have to be near the car. You can't be, 100 metres down the road. You have to hold two buttons on the remote. So if you drop the remote halfway through, the car just comes to a stop.
Right.
It will stop for anything else. It'll stop for other cars. It'll stop for trees and all that sort of stuff. It'll only go, I think it's 15 metres, and forward and back.
Will it do a parallel park? I mean, a reverse park?
It won't do it. It'll do a reverse park when you're in the car, but it won't do the proper, it'll go straight back. It won't do full on turning. It won't do a full lock, for example.
Okay.
But... so where it's handy, if you're in a very tight car park, and this is probably more applicable in Europe where they do like parking close together, but you can wheel it into a spot that's too tight to open your doors in, for example.
If it's rained a lot. And then drive it out again.
And then drive it out again at the end. So you start the thing up and bring it out to you.
I parked like that tonight, actually.
Yeah.
I had to climb into the passenger seat to get out.
Yeah, right. Well, there you go. You could have just got out and remote parked it.
Yeah, okay.
Another one is, let's say it's rained while you've been out to dinner or something. You get back to your car, there's a massive puddle where you are.
Yeah.
And you just go, I'll drive it forward, get out. And plus the neighbours will think, how cool is that? He's got a remote control car.
I do think it's pretty cool. Yeah. I like a point you were making earlier to me too, that at one intersection, you say, in southeast Melbourne, has nabbed 93,000 drivers a year for speeding.
Mm.
If it's as dangerous as that with a speed camera, as you rightly say, why don't they think about redesigning the intersection?
Well, they should be doing something.
Rather than just collecting 93,000 fines.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, for that level of fines in a single year, for them to say, I mean, either we're not getting the truth about, by all these people speeding, we're causing calamity in terms of lives, lost and so on. So it's either not as unsafe as they're saying, or there's a whole pile of people that are causing, risking lives every single day. And this is something I find a little bit hard to believe with this. I know the intersection well. It's a 70k an hour zone generally, but it goes down to 40k an hour in the school zones. Yeah. And I've got a mate who got pinged in this exact one who sort of said, his missus was doing 6 or 8k's over the limit or something. So 46 or 8, it was an hour after school had started. And you made the point of, well, there were no kids around, they're all in class. So look, I think, as I said, if it really is that dangerous, something else has to happen at that intersection to make it safer.
Yes, no, it's a fair point, I think, indeed. All right, Toby, terrific. We could go on forever, and sadly we can't. Now it goes, disappears, doesn't it?
It does, just gone.
Sorry to those, we couldn't get to your calls. I'm sorry, though, we had a completely full board. I tried to get through as many as we can. Toby will be back, so it's not all over yet. Toby, great to see you back.
You too.
Get some sleep.
Sounds good.
Toby, just freshly back from Geneva. News now.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.